Backseat Producers, episode 226, Velvet Goldmine. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Jill.
This is David.
We are the Backseat Producers.
Welcome. Tony's got new equipment and I'm jealous.
It's hot.
Yes. All is color coordinated.
Although, colorful. I'm going to be honest with you, my mics are blacker.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they still have soul.
But are they bigger?
Yes. Nah, I think they're about the same size.
Length or girth?
Both. I mean, I'd have to pull them out at the same time to compare. And, you know, if it's cold out, then
is it damp? Is it cold? What?
Yeah. If there's a pool involved, then we're all at a handicap.
All right. So, change of schedule. We had talked about before that we were going to do Purple Rain, and then Netflix boned us. So
Netflix boned you. I have an Apple TV, so I have access to the media every time.
Well, I could. I have access to it. I don't feel like paying any more for it.
Do not watch it in iTunes. iTunes is the worst piece of software on the planet.
I try not to install it, if I can help it.
You don't have to use it.
No, I don't.
I'm jealous of that.
I don't have an iPod. I don't have an iPhone.
I know.
I don't have an iPad.
Talk about old.
I don't care. I don't care for locked down technology.
Oh, whatever. Were you talking about something else?
Yeah, we're not doing Purple Rain. That's it.
Yep.
Well, what if I already spent the money on it?
Well, congratulations. Write it off.
Enjoy
next
it.
Year. You know what?
Write it off.
Write a review.
Ooh. I don't write.
All right, so next week we're doing Rockstar. The week after that, Spinal Tap.
And that will complete our rock and roll series.
That'll complete our rock and roll series, and I haven't actually done the math on this yet, but I'm pretty sure that, like, the week after I go back to school for 9 weeks.
Oh.
So we'll save High Fidelity and
no,
for when
yeah,
it
our
returns.
John, our John Cusack series.
Well, yes. And it'll be a brother sister series.
Oh yes. Listen. I will commit
all
to watching,
Cusack all the time.
I will commit to watching Better Off Dead.
Backseat Cusack.
Stop. You make me hate the things I do. I will commit to watching Better Off Dead, and I will watch no other John Cusack movies. Unless...
That's a good movie to watch,
unless we're going to watch Hot Tub Time Machine again.
We have watched that and talked about it.
I know. That's why Dossie again on there.
Wouldn't be the first time we've talked about a movie twice.
Every time we have tea on, we talk about like 60 movies we've already talked about.
That's true.
Because that he flies through 100 minutes.
Whoa. The week you'll be in St. Louis. What's this about? So, Lane is in the chat room and saying something about being in St. Louis and then is gushing about David Beckham.
Tied in with food? I need David Beckham.
Wait.
How those two go together.
What ethnicity of food is he?
I don't know.
Because this is going to heavily depend on my answer.
English.
No. Because the English food is terrible.
I can tell you sweet and salty.
Come on.
Well, sweet. Come on out.
The week of the 22nd, yeah.
That's the week we're doing Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
You'll be in just
we'll
the
have
right
to
place.
Figure out
a food
something.
Theme could be really cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of food theme movies out there that are pretty decent. Babette's Feast, Chocolate,
Eating Raoul.
I haven't seen any of them.
Zombieland.
Zombieland. Haven't we done Zombieland?
Yes, we have.
I think so.
Of course we did. As soon as it came out.
Won't have a car. Well, eat, drink, man, woman, yeah.
I'm going to be honest with you, Elaine. I drive, like, the entire length of this city to get here. Like, seriously, my commute here is about an hour each week, so getting you here is probably not a problem, because I probably pass by wherever you're going to be.
That's true. Well, we can work that out, those details
yeah,
we'll out work, later.
Yeah, I'm sure nobody
cares. All right, so, Velvet Goldmine. High-level thoughts. Daryl.
Ooh, but not a big fan of the flashback type telling, but still enjoyed it. I mean, nice little history of glam.
Jill.
I loved it, but I think it has a lot of layers. I don't see it as a historical piece at all. I think it's more of a nostalgic piece, not so much to look back at history, but to question where we are now. I thought there were some phenomenal performances. I thought it was great on the eyes as well as the ears, so I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I expected to hate this movie because I dislike music. And as soon as like that opening crawl thing, like the opening text pops up, I was like, ah, this movie is so pretentious already. And then the last line fades in. I'm like, all right, you got me. That was good. So I actually enjoyed this movie because it wasn't about the music or the history at all.
Yeah, that was just a backdrop.
Yeah. And I thought it was going to be like Quadrophenia. And everything that this movie, everything I hate about Quadrophenia was gone from this movie.
That's...
And that made it a good movie.
That's fair. yeah, I liked it. I wasn't blown away by it as a complete work, but when I break it down, mm-hmm. I really, really like all the pieces. It's odd. Pulling it all together, it was okay. And I don't understand.
But I don't think you can pull it all together.
Well,
and that's probably
why when I sit back and take a look at the whole piece, it's okay. But like the performances, the acting is so great, and the music is really good. And no, even though it's a backdrop, it's still really good.
They capture the essence of that time.
Yeah, the visuals were amazing.
But I think that's why it's not supposed to be taken as a complete piece, because the whole idea behind the time was to have many, many choices to determine who you are.
Yeah.
You know, and so
yeah, I think this is the kind
of
movie that
purpose.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of movie that after having this discussion, whichever way we end up going with it, it'll be interesting to go back and watch to see what everybody else saw in it.
Well, as a huge Bowie fan and a fan of a number of the artists that kind of were threading this, every time I watch it, I find another reference that it almost makes me giggle. That
yeah.
It's like, oh my God, that's from this. Or I liked a lot of the references to Fahrenheit, to 1984. I mean, there's so many complex things going on here.
Yeah, Bowie was a big fan of all that.
Yeah, and Haynes is phenomenal. But I'm a fan of his. I've liked a lot of his work. It's very intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if you're expecting to come in and watch a movie and have it all tied up nice and neat, you shouldn't watch any movies that he does, because he purposely doesn't do those.
Yeah.
It ties into that whole dynamic is nothing in that era was ever finished. It was always in a constant state of change.
For those 3 years, mm-hmm. it did, and he draws your attention to that. It ended, and we got stuck with the Reagan era, bland, gray, monotonous, hell. And I think what he's trying to have us look at now is, can we get back to that? And that's actually a question I was going to throw out to you guys. Are we getting back to a time where people who feel alien in their own families or their own communities, do they have those options? Are we seeing musicians play that kind of Marilyn Manson to what's her face?
Lady Gaga. I mean, that's what she's about. That's
right,
kind of her whole
thing.
But is
the culture adopting it the way Britain did at this time?
No, we're not.
Because America didn't embrace it.
Britain did, or
England did.
Well, it didn't embrace it initially. We kind of morphed into our own little subculture.
Yeah, we got Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we got shit. No, we did.
No,
we got the
glam, but you didn't get the...
we got big hair bands in the
80s. Yeah, big hair bands. You got the persona, but you didn't get much else. It was just a commercial
Well, I think part of that is that you no longer have to publicly express your fandom of these things. Like, for the concerts and things, you don't have to go there anymore to enjoy, like, that artist's work. Mm-hmm. Like, so much of it is, I want to listen to music, so I just listen to it on my computer by myself with headphones on. And that wasn't part of the culture then. Mm-hmm. Part of the culture then was...
It was a shared experience.
Yeah, it was a common
going to
experience.
The, you have to go to the record store. And
go to the record store, interact with the people at the record store, or go to the concert.
Well, interact with the medium in itself.
Yeah. Well, and going to the record store, it's not like you're buying, you know, a basically anonymous MP3 on your computer.
Right.
You have to buy a disc.
Yeah,
it's,
I mean,
huge.
It's big. It's an artifact.
It identifies who you are when you walk it up. And they even showed that, how he had the one, and the guys were busting his balls about it.
Mm. Well, and I loved the future where he plays it again.
Yeah.
And because I think this movie is more about Arthur than it was anybody else.
Oh, yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know? And
it took a while to realize that with the story they were telling. It kind of, I guess it was really the point when you see him in the future and he's basically being put on assignment to go work on this,
right,
to investigate this, to do this thing. And then you kind of realize that, well, it's his story going back and doing this investigation and having to relive his experiences through it. So that's where...
Well, and what I like, too, is, you know, not only relive and go back to a time, which is probably his happiest time, looking at how they portray him in 1984,
mm-hmm.
and then ending it with him getting Oscar Wilde's pin. Not wanting it, returning it, but then getting it, and then I love the shot of him and this almost childlike expression. It's goofy. I mean, it's really, really goofy, but it needed to be because it was... like he got that spark again. And we don't know who he really is going to be. He doesn't know who he's really going to be.
Right.
But there's the optimism for the future.
So you said that you didn't like that there was a lot of untied and unfinished messages. I didn't get the sense of that at all. Like, what exactly are you specifically talking about that wasn't finished? Well, you never do.
I didn't say it. Yeah, they did.
Yeah, they did.
Oh, that was, okay. He was talking to Stone.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think some of it is they never... totally flesh out all of the relationships. It's some of them are fairly superficial, like Jack Ferry kind of just disappears.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, that kind of fits with the whole Oscar Wilde narrative, because that's what Jack Ferry mm-hmm. kind of is the Oscar Wilde of the 70s. So for me, it wasn't an issue.
Well, later he became a cross-dressing comedian. Just to spoil that for you.
Well,
that's what happened.
Yeah, but... you don't need it.
No.
well, Izzard was already in the movie.
I know.
So. And that's not Jack Ferry.
Oh, which one was Jack Ferry?
Jack Ferry was the redhead that was the first person to get Oscar Wilde's pin. He's the one who is kind of the god fairy of the glam rockers. He's the one who establishes
it.
He's the redhead. He's the one
with the creepy eyebrows.
Yes.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
But, no, Eddie Izzard's the...
Son of a bitch. Then my Eddie Izzard Joe doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, no.
I didn't know. I didn't catch anybody's name. We don't use character names here.
Yeah, I also like the way he used music.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he used it in a lot of different ways. You have the traditional kind of soundtrack to kind of push the narrative along.
Mm-hmm.
You had the kind of live music concert part. You had the kind of abstract music video pieces in there,
yeah.
Which wasn't, I mean, that didn't happen in the 70s. They had movies, but they didn't have those kind of,
right.
But I like the fact that he kind of used it in a variety of ways within the narrative
mm-hmm.
that I thought was a little unusual for, you know, a music-based movie.
Yeah, and what I really dug is how the lead actors actually sang
well.
Yeah.
There were times when Jonathan Rhys Meyers sang, and I know they didn't get the rights to any of the songs. They actually approached Bowie to get rights to the songs, and he said no. So they redid them. But there were songs that, like, you could close your eyes and go, oh, that's, you know, Station, or that's 1984. I mean, you could actually kind of go back and go, that's the song, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He would have had. Yeah.
Well, you could hear, it was such a good parody of the kind of the style and his voice, you know, and kind of stuck within this the correct range too. They didn't get into this thin white Duke stuff. They stayed within the kind of the hunky dory, the Ziggy Stardust element. And then I love the fact that they actually did have the rights to 20th Century Boy, because T-Rex, and I can't remember what's the lead singer's name, he's actually, there's a photograph of him in the dressing room at the end as the band is getting ready to go off that last concert. And so the fact that they played 20th Century Boy, I thought was perfect, because he was one of the kind of the faces of glam rock.
Right.
And so to actually have that song in there, I thought was a nice touch.
The Tommy Stone thing, was that's who What's-His-Face became.
Brian Slade became Tommy Stone, yeah.
Thank you. Mark Bolan.
I like that they put that, I like that they showed that, like that he had broken all of his ideals. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, that he...
That everything that he had started fell apart, and then like he couldn't get away from wanting to do something like that again, and then coming back to it.
As... I don't know. I wouldn't say that, because I don't think he ever had an idealism, especially when he gets out there and they ask him, why are you all painted up? And he's like, I'm a whore. This whole business is about being a whore, and I am just living it up. I'm acting the part. I'm tarting myself up and presenting myself in such a way to make myself the whore that is expected of me.
Well, and that's where the Citizen Kane reference comes in. I mean, he purposely chose Citizen Kane because Citizen Kane is all about kind of this reporter to go figure out who Kane is,
right,
and fails. It's the same thing. Reporter goes to figure out who Brian Slade is and fails.
Mm-hmm.
Who he is as a person. He finds out who he is now as in terms of his next persona, but he doesn't ever get to know who Brian Slade is because Brian Slade doesn't know who he is.
I tell you, there was
Brian Slade's whoever he wants to be at the time.
There is a lot about this movie that reminds me of Eddie and the Cruisers.
What is with you? Always with Eddie and the Cruisers.
I don't know, but it does. There's just pieces of it throughout the movie that just remind me of the narrative of Eddie and the Cruisers.
Well, I mean, I get the whole faking the death, coming back kind of piece. I mean,
and the reporter trying to figure out who he is. I mean it's the same type of story. It's the same type of story.
Yeah. No, I dug the way that they played that out. Like they present you with a mystery, but most of the movie is not about solving that mystery.
No.
It's about him
coming to terms with his experiences through that time and how he related to that.
Well, yeah.
That whole movement,
and you know, what I
like that, especially that scene when he's standing there and he's watching television as this press conference is going on, and he's like, "That's me," and then the guy's like, "Oh, and I'm bisexual," you know, and he's like, ugh.
"You know, that's a dream sequence, though. That's not real,
right?
It's in his imagination."
But that just kind of ties what he is to.
Well, the whole movie's about alienation, though. I mean. And being...
I watched that TV show.
Foreign. What?
Alienation.
And that's what I like. And he even does things like... another one of the references that kind of made me giddy was the ginormous Marlene Dietrich photograph behind the manager's desk.
Yeah.
And her reputation was for reinventing herself and pushing the boundaries in terms of what
was that
a woman
really
could
her?
Be.
Yeah. Because it looked like a drag queen.
As her.
Was it really her?
It was, oh. I mean,
did she reinvent herself into a dude?
Well, there were parts where she dressed like a dude.
Mm-hmm. Her cabaret stuff.
I mean, yeah. I mean, she constantly was pushing the boundaries.
So what I liked about this movie is, with most of my experience with music, it takes a very childish view on relationships. And this movie did not have relationships that were childish. They were complicated, messy, and broken, which is mostly, in my experience, actual relationships with people. I don't know very many people who have real relationships that aren't broken in some way.
But they're complex.
Yeah. They're complex. So there wasn't like this one true love bullshit thread kind of weaving its way through there.
No.
Unless it was Christian Bale and Ewan McGregor. I was hoping for a...
a like reconnection there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I
was hoping
I
for a Craigslist misconnection, so man for man.
No, that...
By the way, Ewan McGregor's penis. Did not think I would see Obi-Wan's penis.
I must have missed that.
What?
How did you miss that? That was his like opening scene with him performing with the glitter
on the stage.
And he
pulls down his pants
and he's
I was watching distracted.
I guess so. You
couldn't have missed it. It was zoomed in.
What is with these Rocky dramas and penis?
I don't know.
It's a guy thing.
Why do they like guitars?
It's an extension.
Yeah.
No.
Sometimes
a guitar is just a guitar, guys. Sorry. I don't buy into that everything has to be a penis. Like, this microphone's just a microphone. Like, its shape is because sound travels into it at a specific angle.
He doth protest too much?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that was another... I mean, so he kept putting in things that Bowie actually did. So like that scene with the guitar with Kurt Weill.
Yeah,
he did that with Iggy Pop. I mean, so that was kind of a fun, you know, that's happened before.
No, in the context of this movie, the guitar was mostly a penis. All right.
It's for a lot of musicians, it is.
That's weird.
That's why they call it their axe.
I've never thought of my penis as an axe. Is that where the hatchet wound thing comes from?
I'm not explaining this to you.
Oh, man. I'm going to look this up.
All right. So, Toni Collette was awesome. Ewan McGregor was amazing.
I mean...
Yeah. The first time he was on stage... Injured. Yeah.
He stole every scene he was in. He
usually does.
Was awesome.
If it's not because he's hilarious or commanding, it's because he's well-dressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did read somewhere that apparently the reason why the first kiss between Ewan McGregor and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is apparently not a very good gay kiss is that Jonathan Rhys-Meyers had some concerns about playing this role and being cast as this effeminate, kind of androgynous character. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You're like typecast for that. You look the part, which is why it works.
You look like a girl.
Yeah, you know? and it's beautiful.
With his long hair, I mean, he's a very pretty man. Yeah. There's no denying it.
Well, the Kurt Cobain thing actually wasn't done on purpose. I saw an interview with Todd Hayes, and Iggy Pop dyed his hair silver, and so they had... Ewan McGregor dye his hair to kind of look like it, and apparently Tom Hayes kind of missed the whole Kurt Cobain thing until after they were in pre-production, and all of a sudden was looking at it going, oh yeah, I kind of see it, which I found ironic considering that last song he sings at the final concert struck me as very Kurt Cobain, not Iggy Pop at all, and so it was funny to kind of hear him say that he didn't even make the connection so much later.
Those are definitely people.
So you don't know any old...
No, I know Kurt Cobain.
Well, but you don't know like Iggy Pop, Lou Reed?
Nope.
Mm-hmm. Brian Eno?
Nope. These are all people.
He did a lot of work for the movie, too.
You're here
from
Brian
looking
Eno
at the,
every time you start up your...
From looking at... Yeah.
And there are some elements of Jack Ferry that kind of are like Brian Eno, like the fact that he kind of took Kurt Cobain under his wing and took him to Berlin is kind of what Brian Eno did. Brian Eno did a series of albums with David Bowie post Ziggy Stardust called the Berlin series that were kind of influenced. But I mean, Lou Reed, the electric shock thing with Kurt Cobain, or with that, I said Kurt Cobain, with Kurt Wilde is all from Lou Reed's history. That his parents were worried about his
gayness,
his androgynous behavior, and so they put him in a mental institution for a while.
Electroshocked until they could
get the clean,
get the gay out of him,
get the queer out of him,
directly out of.
And it just
Reed's
made
life.
Him
they
crazy.
They didn't pray the gay away. Yeah. They machine washed it.
Yeah. So there's all these elements
I like that how they did that. You know, they tried to shock the gay out of him, but it just made him crazy.
Made him into a rock musician.
Here. Take a walk on the wild side. And you know, Jeff brings up Take a Walk on the Wild Side. That was directly David Bowie's influence on Lou Reed, that he tried to kind of turn him into this glam rock kind of persona with that album. So that's kind of a good reference.
Looking at Lou Reed now, it's weird to think of him in that
glam era.
In that era.
Well, yeah. What's really kind of
because
when you listen to his stuff, it makes perfect sense now.
Well, his influence. He went through most of his career thinking he was kind of a failure. I mean, nobody really liked him, and he was kind of. But yet, he influenced so many people. And it wasn't really until like the 80s and 90s that he started to kind of go, oh, these people are actually like interested in bringing me in and working with me, and you know, they respected him. And he's married to Laurie Anderson, who's kind of an interesting artist in her own right. She's a performance artist. Yeah, I saw her in the 80s when I was in high school in Boston, and she was performing in a full percussion suit. So she basically played drums on her body. It was pretty bizarre. It was really cool.
She had a dress made out of rhythm machine. It was basically
like a rhythm box, but it was her whole body, and it was a suit.
So every time she touched the sensor, it would trigger a drum machine.
Depending on where she hit, it would have a different sound, and it was a really cool, bizarre experience. But he's married to her, which I always thought, like, wow, if you guys had kids, it would be really strange.
Yeah.
It would be almost frightening.
Yeah, it would be frightening.
Yes, techno would never be the same.
You know. But she's amazing and she's brilliant in her own right.
Does she still perform?
Yeah, but she does. I think she's mostly doing stuff with violin because she's a violinist as well. She's got a really pretty amazing background in terms of music and art. And she's an art history professor.
Good Lord.
Kind of cool.
She's got all the professional and academic chops.
Yeah. Well, and that's the kind of interesting thing about all the people they're referencing in this movie. They really were intellectuals of their time, but yet morphed, you know, and kind of created this spectacular spectacle, really, that on the surface doesn't seem very intellectual, but yet
you have to
is
sit
very
back and
liberating.
Think about it for a minute.
Yeah, I mean, so like the pairing, like the looking at Oscar Wilde and Dorian Gray, I mean, that was all purposeful.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of a cool piece of time. You need to listen to some of it.
No.
Yeah, you do. Because
here's the thing. Here's my problem with this. Like, would you say that music has played an integral part in your development as a person?
Absolutely.
Yep. Do you think that is the case for a lot of people?
I would hope so, but since we live in the United States, I don't think it is. No, I really do. I think this movie is an indictment of the United States and the fact that all of these really cool cultural changes don't happen in the United States. They come over and they morph a little bit, but they die away to grayness.
Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that.
I mean, yeah, a lot of our musical stuff tends to do better overseas.
Yeah.
And when it comes back, I mean...
Mm-hmm. Well, and you can go back
The thing is, techno was invented in the United States. But it is huge in Europe, and it's not that big.
And the 80s, the acid house movement in the 80s with all of electronic music.
Yeah, but mostly was taken by Europe and just run with.
I'm a big fan of progressive metal, and a lot of that stuff gets much more play in Asia and Europe than it ever does here.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just
your mom's house, yeah.
But I have a problem with that. I mean, I appreciate that you don't, but
found
I do.
Music has never had an impact on my life. It just never will. It's entertaining to listen to. Science has proved that your brain likes music. It just does.
But you've never like had a song actually move you in any way.
No.
I feel sorry for you then.
We've established over and over. He's a soulless automaton.
I don't have an emotional connection to music. There's no emotional connection there. Now, I have memories tied to music. I mean, I can remember listening to certain songs when certain events were happening, but there's no emotion there. That's just like, where were you when you found out about 9/11? I can tell you where I was, but it's not like there's any sort of emotion tied to that.
Well, because I was going to bring up one of the connections between last week's movie and this one that really resonated with me, particularly with Velvet Goldmine, was Lester Bangs. says that, and I'm going to read it because I'm horrible at quoting stuff. Music, you know, true music, not just rock and roll, it chooses you. It lives in your car or alone listening on your headphones, you know, with the cast scenic bridges and angelic choirs in your brain. It's a place apart from the vast benign lap of America. And this movie, and maybe too, because when I got into Bowie, you know, I felt like an alien. I was in a Catholic school that I really didn't belong in. I was different than everybody else because I grew up in an artistic environment. I was going to Cambridge instead of going to the football games. So for me, Bowie and his music really spoke to me, and it got me listening to a range of stuff. I never would have gone to Laurie Anderson. I mean, I was, you know, a high school kid. Mm-hmm. And so I like that aspect. And this movie kind of resonates with me in that way, in that you can be an alien and find other aliens and that connect with you and create your own community. Alien. Well, that's right. It. And then you're not from another planet.
Yeah.
You are the planet.
Yeah, you know? And the fact that these are creative, smart, intellectual people, and I could be projecting, but
no, I think
that that's a really cool element, and I think we are missing a lot of that.
I think the difference there is that people don't have to be alienated as much, and they don't have to be outed with their alienation and in groups anymore because they have the internet. They can be, you know, an alien
in the
privacy of their
or
own
they
bedroom.
Create
they can
an
find,
avatar and never really deal with who they are.
Right, they can. At the same time, though, I had a group of friends that I knew from work or from, you know, whatever, but the biggest group of people that I've ever considered friends are the people that I have gotten from podcasting, because I can find more people with more like interests to me expanding out through this culture than I ever could just meeting people up and down the street. I don't care to hang out with my neighbors because, you know what, I really don't have a whole lot in common with them.
Yep.
One or two, maybe, out of a couple of blocks worth of people. I just don't have any interest in it. But when I expand that out to the people that I can find on Twitter, on Facebook, you know,
whatever, yeah,
wherever, to sit around on a Wednesday night and talk about movies, this community, and the one that is kind of has grown around this, I think is far more interesting and collaborative, and I enjoy the people more. Even if we do have different tastes, different interests in movies, the conversations we can have around them are what's interesting.
Right. Like, podcast, like, for me, and I'm sure it's the same way for you, like, this is a major part of my life, not because we talk about movies, but because I have an emotional connection to this.
Yeah.
Not necessarily this, but...
Right, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't
have an emotional connection to this. Yeah.
This is an integral part of my development of the person I am right now.
Yeah.
Over the last 5-6 years of doing this.
Yeah, I mean... the end of this month, this podcast is 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I have done podcasting longer than I have done any job in my life. I mean, that's just a fact. And I've created this job for myself.
Out of a passion.
Yeah.
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 And that should be key in terms of creating jobs.
Right.
To do sometimes.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough.
And the thing is, it's a matter of, you know, it's not even about what movies we talk about or even movies. I just enjoy getting together with people and having interesting conversations. That's why every so often I'll jump onto a comic book podcast or a video game podcast, because that group of people seems interesting to talk to, so I'm going to go talk to them. And this just facilitates conversations. It's great.
Should get into football, Tony. Watch Packers.
Don't have any interest in football.
Yes!
It's not about football. Well, for me, it's mostly about the football.
Yeah.
I can pretend it's not about the football.
Well, and Jeff asked a good question in terms of, you know, music moving you in movies. I mean, I think that's the power of a soundtrack and why they have music. Even in the silent movies, they had music was
right
to connect in some way.
Oh, I'll tell you, the score of Superman, that gets me. I mean, just right here, you know, I'm just ready.
Pumped.
I'm pumped. I just enjoy it. The opening to Gonna Fly Now, Rocky. I'm ready to, you know, I'm ready to go hit something, ready to go jog up a set of stairs. It's just It's inspiring. It's uplifting.
Yeah, when I do my running,
John Williams does that to me.
But well, so he's, music doesn't move. He's designing the sound field to do that on purpose.
Yeah,
it's to make
he's
you
good at it.
Yeah, he is really good.
He's a good artist, and he's evoking the emotions out of me that he's trying to.
Well, I'm curious though. If music doesn't move you, is there another art form that does? I mean, obviously, you're drawn to movies for a reason.
Yeah, it's well.
I mean, because you obviously think about them.
Does music have the depth of a narrative that I need to get into to establish an emotional connection? Like, this movie is actually a great example. The music, all of the music I could have cut out of the movie entirely. If they would have cut all of it out and done all of those scenes where they're singing as silence and maybe a voiceover, I would have enjoyed the movie more. What I enjoyed about the movie was that it was realistic enough for me to get into it and understand the situation that the people are in. Like, the broken relationships, I understand that on a very real, emotional level. So, in the end, when Brian Slade has given up, I saw him as giving the him faking his own death was him getting out because he realized that he'd lost everything that he was working towards. And coming back to the stage under an alternate identity was him desperately trying to get back to the dream that he failed earlier in his life. And the broken relationship between him and Kurt, I thought the most poignant thing that is ever said about that relationship is when Christian Bale walks into the back of that bar and Kurt's sitting there and he's got a crumpled up ticket from the show that he went to see. And you know that Kurt and Slade never talked about it. But even after everything that had happened between them, he still cared enough about him to go follow him, to continue on. And it was important to Kurt to keep his secret.
But the interesting that you talk about that relationship, the song that's playing, Bittersweet, the song that's playing when they're splitting up.
Go ahead.
Bittersweet's playing when they break up, when Brian Slade decides he's done with the band. It's also when you see Kurt. It's playing when Kurt leaves to go to Berlin. It's also playing when it's the same song when Arthur is coming to London, and then it break the band that he hooks up with in London. They actually break out and actually sing it. So you get different voices singing the same song. And it's thread on purpose, and the song Bittersweet's on purpose to tie in all of those things and those emotions of those characters in the one. So I think it adds another layer of complexity to it that, I mean, I don't know, but I've always been a music fan, so.
And I'm not really a music fan, so I didn't even notice that was the same song.
Yeah.
So.
This is a movie. It sounds like you almost had to watch two or three times to pick up on all the little nuances.
Oh, and
if
I would
more than that. Yeah.
Oh, I think you'd
which
have
is
to.
Why this movie probably had such a hard time at the box office. There's just so much going on the screen. You just can't take it all in one sitting.
And I didn't realize because I looked at the numbers and it didn't make money. But I also didn't realize that the week that they went to start shooting the movie, they slashed the budget. So Todd Haynes in an interview said it's the cheapest he could possibly make the movie for, and it was one of the most stressful. It was the bare minimum, and part of the reason why was because he would not give up anything in terms of control over the movie. And so after that is when because the movie was well received by
the critics,
by people like Scorsese. Scorsese saw it at Cannes and said it's what made him want to go back to directing. And that he was able to get the budget he needed for Far for Heaven, which was an Oscar contender and won in a number of categories. So so that was kind of an instant. I wonder if he had the extra. It was only $1 million, but what that would have done in terms of being able to.
In watching the movie, I never felt like I was watching something with corners cut or anything like that because I didn't know. And I would have never guessed that whatever budget they had been cut.
Yep.
I never got that feeling.
Now I'm kind of, well, I didn't either until I read it, and now I'm kind of going, all right, well, what did he want it to look like?
Right. What would have been different? I mean, I can imagine that maybe some of the...
even in an indie film, is not a whole lot when you time you chew it up. Into
but depending on,
it's a tenth of his budget.
I would bet some of the music video sequences could have been a lot more vibrant and
elaborate.
Well,
and I wonder if it could have been another week of shooting.
Maybe.
You know, I don't know.
Filling some of the more of the holes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that there was really any holes.
I think the story they were telling
is... one of the biggest complaints by critics is that it is a movie that has no unified purpose.
I agree.
But that was one of the biggest complaints.
Okay.
That sounds like a critic.
Bale's story. Like, that's the purpose of this. What?
But people don't like that because we don't know.
I'm with you.
We don't know where he's going to go.
I don't care where he goes.
I don't either. Well, and I like I said, the smirk, you know that there's something good's going to happen. So you don't need to know after that.
Even if something good's not going to happen, it's... okay, so he embarks on this journey where he doesn't want to go back to remember this kind of... you claim happiest time of his life. It looks more turbulent to me than anything else. But, like, that's kind of grown up. Everybody goes through that period, like, in their teenage years and then kind of early 20s where, you know, you don't know who you are.
Yeah, at the time...
he's gay, though. I mean, and... Well, he's excited to figure out who he is.
But it's also very traumatic to him. Of course. Mm-hmm. So looking back on it, he could look at it just depending on how he looks at it. It's either his grand discovery and he's very thankful for that and he's positive about it, or it's his outing and he's terrified of it and he's got horrible memories and painful events.
Right, so
yes, it's both.
So he's got like this encounter that he has with Kurt when he's younger. And that kind of solidifies, which it's presented as the kind of the culmination of his involvement in the story. And so years later, he meets this guy again. Guy has no idea who he is, but they sit down and they have an earnest conversation.
He remembers who he is in the flashback scene.
Yeah.
It goes from Brian Slade to them on the roof. Kurt Wilde remembers who he is.
He eventually remembers.
Oh, okay, sure.
It's in the flashback.
Yeah. Initially, he doesn't. But yeah.
Well, and that flashback's purposely deceiving because it's they're all both in white and it's kind of murky. But he remembers Arthur.
Well,
on the
either way, he has that, like, that was the culmination of his flashback experience, and then later he meets up with this guy again. And they have a conversation, and they're both, well, now Christian Bale is an adult, and he's kind of looking back on this with another person who's looking back on the same thing, and they're both remembering different aspects, and it's very conclusionary. I'm fine with that story because it's a nice capstone
even
to
the
journey of remembering
even
that time.
Even the mystery of where is Brian Slade is resolved.
Yeah, I mean, what isn't
granted. Granted, we don't know what happens after. Does he get exposed? Is the fact that he has, that somebody knows, is that enough exposure? But you know what? Who cares? That's not what it's about.
Isn't the reference? Exactly. Isn't the fact that it's referencing David Bowie also kind of alluding to the fact that he's just constantly going to reinvent himself?
Probably.
I mean,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And at that point, that's. I don't think that's really what.
Yeah, that's what
it's about.
Yeah, I don't either.
So I mean, I'm fine with the story as presented. Like, you can play the what happens next game with any piece of media that's ever been written, unless the character dies in the end.
Right. Yeah, all right, I think it's a matter of expectations.
Throw ourselves off into the West. What happens next?
Yeah, what happens in the West?
Loose end.
Someone needs a theme song.
Yeah, apparently Jeff said I need a theme song because it would enhance the emotion he would feel when he hears me speak.
Speaking of Jeff, so Jeff brings up that we saw the John Williams performance at the Symphony Orchestra, and the Star Wars Imperial March theme comes on, and there's no emotional connection there, but there are a lot of fond memories that are associated with that. And it's not necessarily watching the movie, it's like that's representative of what I consider to be the geek culture and my relationship with it. Like, it's one of those things that you identify with that. I don't know that there's an emotion there. Like, I have emotions... I share emotions with people, not necessarily with, like, a hobby. And while I can accept the argument that my relationship with the geek culture is with the people, but that's not really... that's not how I identify that song. It's like it comes on and you're like, this is an iconic song. Like, it is culturally iconic. Like, massively iconic.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing it performed live, there's... It's different than hearing it, like, at the beginning of the movie or when Darth Vader walks onto the screen for the first time. Like,
aren't you having an emotional response if you actually are saying it's different? And it's not that you have to...
It's a different performance. I mean, concert quality. Right. It's the same thing with... They did Lord of the Rings, right? And when they did Lord of the Rings, they played the movie, and then the symphony does the accompaniment, like, down there, and then you watch the movie up here. It was a superior experience, but only because part of the quality of the music is lost in a recording. Like, you miss out on the acoustics, you miss out on the...
Right, it enhances the experience.
But not for an emotional reason. The music is just better. It's like listening to a dude perform a song live... and listening to him play it recorded. Like, you'd want to hear it live, because a guitar over there sounds better than the recording. The recording is always going to be...
It's just purely an aesthetic.
Yeah, always going to be flatter. Purely aesthetic.
See, because that's interesting, because, like, I watch, like The Voice, and it's all the idea of not looking at the person, and just judging on a voice. And they had this blues musician from Memphis come and play, and... he was phenomenal. A phenomenal blues musician. Great song. And I knew he wasn't going to win because it wasn't clean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't this marketable. But that's what's great about the blues. Is it's gritty and soulful.
Well, right.
And
it's not supposed to be perfect.
Well, it is. It's supposed to be a human emotion. It's supposed to be gritty. And it's not always sad. It can be happy, too. But it's supposed to get you on a more visceral level, not aesthetic.
It's normally played live. I mean, once you take something out like that and take it into studio and you clean it all up and
Buddy Guy live is phenomenal. Buddy Guy on CD is, I mean, if you turn it up loud, it still can
get you. I'll tell you, what was amazing to me was the first time I had heard a concert performance from Metallica. Because I had heard... No. Bite me. Because Metallica, James Hetfield, the lead singer, growls through every song on the CD. But you can't do that live for 2 hours. You cannot. You can't. It destroys your voice. You can't do it. He sings in concert. And it's amazing.
Yeah,
a completely different experience listening to those songs sung in concert versus growled through the...
Some songs... are better on the CD, alright?
Like, some of them are.
Some of them are, and a lot of times it's because the performing artist doesn't have a good stage presence.
Or they're not technically a good musician. And the studio engineer makes
anybody sound good.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the pop performances are, I mean, they're just not as good.
We'll give you an example. If you listen to early Pink Floyd, on CDs, and then you try to listen to the stuff in the live version, the CDs are going to sound superior because they can do so much. Some of those audio tricks are going to sound so much better on a recording than they are in live.
Yeah, the Cars are like that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Cars, I saw them live and almost walked out because they were so bad.
It's not so bad. It's just that
they were so bad.
They were bad. Okay.
I mean, and some of it is because they need the electronics.
Yes.
In order to
you need the
good.
Sound effects and the audio engineering to make it work.
Yeah, and there's a lot of musicians that you go to and you listen to, and instead of this cold technical performance that you get on the CD, this very bland, which is great. It's what I liked.
It's what I bought the CD for.
Exactly. It's what I bought the CD for. It's what I listen to. It's what I'm used to. But when they get in concert and live and they react to the audience and there's a different vibe to it, it's not that it's necessarily better or worse. Sometimes it is better. Sometimes it is worse. But sometimes it's just different, and it can hit you, and you just feel more part of the experience.
The showmanship of the we saw.
Yes.
We saw All American Rejects last week, and so they've got their Move Along, like that's their big song. So in the beginning, it's just
others?
Dirty Little Secret.
Oh yeah.
Give You Hell, and there's another one, but I don't remember.
Yeah,
what.
Basically a Glee soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when they like Move Along starts with this like really deep bass riff like a few measures or whatever, So he started it, and then like you can like kind of get into the motion of the song, and then he stopped the drummer, and then like it hurt. Like, and that was part of the showmanship. Like, he'd start the drum, and then you would like get ramped up for the beat, and then he would stop it, and then he's like, "Oh, did you guys want me to continue?" Like, and that was an awesome way to perform the song to get you even more ramped up for it. Because like once it starts, that kind of beat stays through the whole song, and you expect it. And then, like, when it's,
but isn't that an emotional
it's like,
response?
It's like stopping to pee. Like,
but isn't that an emotional response, though?
No, it's showmanship.
But the audience, and you're even the way you're talking about it, you had an emotional response to it.
That's not an emotional response to it.
Just because you weren't sobbing in tears doesn't mean it's not.
It didn't inspire me to create an empire.
You wanted more.
I wanted to play Tropico.
I'm saying from a clinical perspective,
there was an expectation he set, and then he took it away from me, and that made my expectation greater.
That's manipulating your emotion.
It's not a rational thought on your part.
No, it's not emotional.
That's playing with the audience's head.
It's an emotional response.
Well, that's somewhat rational. If I like cook you a gourmet meal, and you like you just barely pick it up, and I take it away from you, you're like, what the fuck?
Is this part of the service?
There's no emotion attached to the food, but like, well, I've given you a little taste of it, and then you're like, well, now I want it, and now I want it more because you've given me a little taste.
You're just a tease.
Yeah, and an emotional vampire.
I think emotional eunuch is more like it.
No, there's no
burn.
No, I have really intense emotions about
it. I'm teasing.
So,
don't be so emotional.
Oh my god. So we're sitting there, okay? So
jeez,
we're kind of
somebody get him a Midol.
Looking up this, we're sitting at this bar thing, and we're kind of right in front of the stage, but we're in the 21 and up area. It's like fenced in from all
so there's like five of you up there?
No, I mean it was pretty full. So there's all these
all the parents who had to drive the 14-year-olds.
Yeah, oh, there were like three of those behind us. We're like, I don't even know who these people are. I'm just chaperoning my friend's kids. And I'm like, great. So
get another drink and shut up.
Yeah, so like for the opening act, whatever, like the two seats in front of us are just empty, so it's like straight on view. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect. And then these two girls show up who are apparently 21 or over, but you could have fooled me. One of the chicks was Asian, so you can't tell how old they are. You never can. And then
the other chick was Indian, and I'm like, wow.
This is a weird mismatched lesbian couple. I don't think they were lesbians.
Well, we just lost the gay market now.
No, not with this movie. Come on. So they're sitting there, and like they asked me to take their picture like 8 times with the whatever thing in the backdrop. I'm like, what's going on?
Start charging them?
No, I didn't. One of them was kind of cute. So, like, the opening act comes on, and they're, like, kind of doing, like, the sway and bob thing, because where they have to stand where they are, and we're sitting, but we're kind of, like, at eye level with each other. So they start doing this bob and sway. So All American Rejects comes on, and there's maybe 4 square feet of open space where they're standing, and they get into it. I mean, they start dancing, and they're, like, screaming the words at each other, and I'm looking at Melina, I'm like, what the fuck is going on in front of us? One of the chicks has a beer, and like the whole area, like the whole floor around her is just completely soiled from this beer that she spilled all over the place. I'm like, what is happening here? So I'm looking at these two chicks.
They sound like they're enjoying a concert.
Yeah,
is what it sounds
like. These
two
chicks enjoying this concert, and they're, well, no one in the 21 area is moving. Everyone else is sitting down, and no one's moving. So it's just these two rocking out, and no one else is moving. So I'm looking at these two chicks enjoy this concert on a level I will never enjoy any concert.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they just fell into their own little headspace there, and like the whole world.
Like nobody
exist.
Else was there. Yeah.
They were just—it's our purpose.
They had their own space, and they were just rocking out with each other.
Good for them.
And the singer dude, and I was like, on one level I'm jealous. On the other, these people look really stupid.
Do?
They don't care.
They look stupid to me.
But do they care?
I don't care that they don't care. They look stupid to me. And if I was them and I was thinking, man, I'm looking at myself be really stupid, I'm out for that.
But apparently they it sounds like they had a much better time than you did.
Probably.
Who loses in this equation?
No one. No one loses.
It sounds like you do.
No one loses in this equation.
Because you're annoyed by their enjoyment of it.
I'm not annoyed by their enjoyment of it.
You're admitting that they probably had a better time than you did.
No, no, I'm not admitting. I'm telling you they had a better
well,
time.
Then there you go.
One, I didn't even want to go see them all.
Isn't that what you just started arguing about?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to make sure I didn't, like, miss that part.
No, no, no.
Because you disagreed with them.
I didn't just agree with them.
You did.
No, no, I'm not agreeing with you. I'm telling you they had a better time at the concert than I did.
Okay.
And isn't that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I want to make sure, no, you know, I know I'm older than he is.
You're implying.
But I want to make sure I'm following this.
You're implying that you tricked
logic.
Me into saying that. I'm not. I didn't say it.
I know. I tricked you into saying it. I was just making a statement.
Yeah, no. It's
and
accurate.
I'm just pointing out
they
that
won the fun
you.
Game.
There
at
was
the
no
concert.
Fun game. There's no competition.
Apparently they thought it was. They
no,
had they had a great time.
They weren't doing it. All right. They weren't doing it to show off. They were
no.
doing it because
they were
in
the
concert.
Zone.
Yeah, they were having fun.
I was in
fun.
This concert.
It's called getting into the groove.
Malia wanted to go see him. I went with her. That was what happened.
Sounds like they were more entertaining than anything. The show was there
they were
and up on stage.
More entertaining. Secondly, like, if you want to see the emotional connection to the music, I'm watching this guy on the stage, and I'm like, this guy is a mediocre singer, and these songs are okay. But, like, this guy does have a good stage presence. Like, he knows how to work the crowd. And, like, he is, like, jumping on stuff, and he's all over the place. Like, he is putting a massive amount of energy into the
show. He's putting on a show.
Yeah, and I'm jealous because he has the dedication. They've been doing this, what, 10 years? I'm jealous that he has the dedication to have built a following and dedicate his life to this thing that, like, they filled the pageant.
And to put out that much energy.
Yeah, exactly.
Every night.
Yeah, I mean, because I don't get the impression that St. Louis was special in some way. Like,
but there was,
I imagine this was an average performance.
Right.
Yeah, but he had two super fans down there probably just feeding off his energy.
Yeah, and that wasn't even the people up next to the stage. So, I mean, that was... That's not cool. That's frustrating because I'm jealous. And then I feel like I've somehow failed because I'm not that guy. Because he looks like a moron. And so, like, then I start comparing me to him. Like, this isn't... The show
That's
is not,
not your passion, though.
The show is not eliciting this emotional response from me. I am forcing this emotional response into a situation where it is totally inappropriate. So that's not the music.
Yes,
the music's not eliciting.
Yes, but guess who got the backstage passes later on that
Does
evening?
Does this get to be cross-referenced as a therapy podcast as well?
Probably.
You know, the seasons are
Backseat
changing,
therapist.
And like I have weird seasonal affective things. Like this is a bad time for me, just emotionally. Anyways, it's
the
just, oh,
one of the original taglines.
Listening to Barbara Streisand all the time.
No,
now,
I don't.
Right? One of the original taglines of Fanboy SmackDown, what the podcast was before Backseat Producers, it's an autobiographical cathartic experience through film. And I think this we just proved it again.
Well, but that's the beauty of movie stuff.
Yeah.
In any kind of
any
know,
art
story. You know, where there's some sort of narrative that you can connect with on a different level or tie it into your life in a safe environment because you're talking about somebody else. You know, you're looking at somebody else go through those experiences.
Right, yeah, right, and there it is right there. And with,
you know what?
With a movie, you can get a longer form experience. I don't think that a 3-minute song has ever accurately summed up my experience with things. I feel more complicated than the 3-minute song does. I like poetry, but the shorter poems I don't feel ever get me there.
And
like
I don't have that same experience because I do have things that touch parts of me. They don't
well,
touch
too,
all of me.
People are too complex.
The bad parts.
Yeah. Well, and what you were just saying about watching somebody else go through it. Watching the first time we see Ewan McGregor on stage. And he is up there and just
doing his thing,
and he's pouring oil
like
all
that.
Over himself,
yeah.
and just he's making this grand spectacle of himself, and it's not. I don't get the impression he's doing it for anyone other than himself.
Yep.
He is just in his moment,
and it's reflected later when he's on stage with Brian Slade, and he comes on and he's late, and he just starts gyrating, and nobody else is
right.
Same song, and yeah, I mean that's his connection.
It is, and. But what was cool was just to see Obi-Wan up there.
How did you miss his penis in the scene?
I don't know.
I looked away because I was doing something else.
Tony, it's implied that it's cold outside and he has no loss. There's no kerf loss.
So my point is that seeing that actor that I've seen in other things not as that character was just, it was such a striking performance from him. And it was amazing.
Yeah, Ewan McGregor's a pretty fantastic actor.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew that before, but this was a way I had never seen him before, and it made me appreciate his work even more.
I don't know how you missed the penis.
I don't know how you missed the penis.
How did you miss the lightsaber?
I was working!
So, side note, last story.
I was at work! I had a database up over the screen at the time. I could not see it.
It was a tuple. Side note from All American Rejects. So, when they finished their first set, like, he Marty McFly style, like, freaks out, like, at the end of Johnny Be Good.
Mm.
Like, all over the place. And so, he says, "We're not coming back out." And then they leave the stage, but they don't bring the lights up, so it's obvious they're coming back out. And Lena turns to me, and she's like, "Man, I feel like this is the end of Back to the Future, and he just Marty McFly'd all over the stage, like, tore the place up." And I'm like, "Yep, I'm pretty sure that just happened." So he comes out, and he starts playing, like, he grabs a guitar, and it's just him and nobody else. Everybody else doing stuff in the background. And he starts playing a song, and it's Earth Angel. He starts playing Earth Angel, and like three notes in, I'm like, "Oh my god, it's playing Earth Angel!" And he's like, "What?" And I'm like, "Oh, you're missing how sublime this moment is right now. You don't see it."
That's not an emotional response.
Not because of the song. It was the coincidence of her mentioning Back to the Future immediately, and then
the song ties it in, though.
It doesn't. It would have meant nothing if she hadn't just mentioned it a few seconds before.
Okay.
Oh my god.
Still, I say
you guys have. Yeah, it is. It was pretty awesome. You guys have this weird, like, emotional thing.
That's awesome. Jeff says, "It sounds like Adam is channeling Brian Slade, watching Kurt Wilde for the first time, and being jealous of Wilde's emotional connection with him."
That's actually probably pretty accurate.
And wishing he had thought of it.
Yeah, actually, that's a fairly perfect analogy. I'm okay with it.
Yeah, and I think that was the coolest part about that scene. It wasn't just seeing Kurt Wilde up there rocking out. It was then going back and looking at Brian Slade's reaction to it.
Well,
and he was just in awe.
And
it was like everything he wanted to do and was trying to do.
And the next scene where forcing. He's like, "Yeah, I'm jealous. I didn't think of this first."
Yep.
Well, but that's what I loved
jealous
about.
Jealous that I can't perform this.
No, it was the fact that it was so different. But I love the fact that it was part of the character development too, with Mandy going, "But you will think of this." You know, and there he does, and he goes.
That chick was hotter than she should have been.
Toni Collette?
Yeah.
Why do you think she was hotter than she should have been?
I don't know. I don't know.
Too
what
many
that,
Muriel Wedding
vibes? I don't know what that is.
Oh, that's another one of her movies.
I don't know.
Sixth Sense.
Nope.
Yeah, that was her from one of her first breakouts in America.
She was great in that, too.
I've liked her in everything. But
she was the mom in Sixth Sense.
She was also the schizo mom in About a Boy, the Hugh Grant movie.
I haven't seen that one.
Hugh Grant.
She's really good in that.
We should watch that when he comes back.
Muriel's Wedding is actually really good. Talk about a messed up emotional mess. But she's great in that. And that was like another thing. Like when he walks up to her at the New Year's Eve and says, "Do you jive?" That's a direct line that David Bowie said to his first wife.
I love how when she comes back with the divorce papers, he's literally doing coke off somebody's ass. That was pretty fantastic.
I saw that.
Doing coke off the ass?
Yeah, I saw it. And Ewan McGregor's penis. Booyah. I'm one penis up on you, Tony.
Apparently. You win?
Do we have a running score?
I don't know.
Somewhere on the website?
This is going to my penis tracker diary.
But is this like the liquometer?
I wrote that to him.
Well, what did you think in terms of connecting it back? I know I wasn't here last week, but to Almost Famous in terms of the idea of performance and music, because I realized after the fact that we probably should have watched this one first, then Almost Famous, because Almost Famous comes right after.
Right. This one actually
71 to 73.
Yeah. So it's
a little bit off, but
probably we could always change the sequence because neither episode's been released yet. So I think it's interesting how you can correlate. Now I'm blanking on the character name from Almost Famous, Russell. Russell and the rest of his band to Brian and Kurt in this movie, because one of them is about just being the musician they want to be, and the other is about striving to be this great iconic thing that people will adore.
Yeah, this performer.
This idol. And I get the sense, like, Jeff Beebe, the Jason Lee character in Almost Famous, he's the character that's kind of like Brian Slade in this. He's the one who wants to be popular and idolized and this rock star.
Yep.
And Russell is great. He's a phenomenal musician. And he just wants to be a guy who's playing music.
Well, it's his passion.
Yeah, it's what he's about.
Draws people to him.
And it's great because the end of the movie when they finally sit down and do that last interview, and he asks the question he keeps asking over and over and over again: what is it you love about music? And he sits down and he just says, "Everything. I love everything about music." And he's finally able to expose his passion and not be this rock star. This
Yeah, well, or even the role within the band itself where I'm supposed to stay in
behind. I'm supposed to stay behind. I'm supposed to let myself hold myself back because the stakes have gotten to the point where everybody's got bills because we kept getting bigger and more popular, and I can't break out beyond. I can't let myself be that next quantum level that I am, that everybody knows I am. But if I do that, then the rest of these guys fall behind, and they're my buddies. And I don't want to do that to them.
Yeah. Well, and Jeff brought up a good point on the listener about how both of these movies, the main character is a reporter.
Right.
You know, and I thought that was and it's also still a kind of a coming of age. Mm-hmm. Even though Arthur is older, the narrative that he's kind of going through is about
a rediscovery.
It's kind of interesting because Arthur's story, then, if you look at it, it's like Billy and what's his name? Philip Seymour Hoffman's character.
Lester.
Lester. Yeah. Bite me.
Yeah, I love Lester. Lester. Awesome.
Lester's great. I loved his character. But those characters, I mean, they are. Lester and Billy are the same characters, just two sides of the coin. One's just lived through the experience and is a little bit more jaded, and is trying to protect Billy from the emotional growth that he's going to go through being a 15-year-old going through all of this stuff. And what's interesting, if you look, Arthur's playing both roles. Mm-hmm. He is the 15-year-old going through all of that stuff, and he's looking back on it and reacting to his emotional story and as he's discovering this mystery.
But yet not fully developed.
No.
He's not as grizzled as Lester.
He's not as grizzled as Lester. And I don't necessarily believe that Lester believes all the bullshit that he's slinging.
Oh, I think for that time period, if you're looking at the references, and that's what I thought. Well,
there's a lot of references,
And then where he sees music going, where it's about money and not about performance, and it's starting to get really, really big. I think he's fairly accurate in that point.
I think his delusion, though, is that there was ever a time when it was not about money.
I think particularly when bands are starting up, I do think that it wasn't about money, and I think it was.
No, I'm talking about the industry
in general.
The industry as a whole,
right?
I think
because Lester's point is the industry is making this change when it's really not. It's about the growth of a band from being idealistic and being.
I think, but he's talking
the fire
about
that changes
roll,
the world.
And I think when you're looking at the difference between true rock and roll bands versus what we have now, which is just basically pop, where everything is commercialized, and it all sounds the same.
Well,
I think that there is a difference, and I think that that's what he was kind of alluding to in that is that bands were starting to be the same as opposed to being individual. Now, I also think there's a little bit of delusion of grandeur on his part.
Yeah.
And he was kind of playing the crotchety art critic. Right. I am, you know, the enemy. And that was the role because he was such an outsider in every other venue mm-hmm. that he accepted that role as the outsider.
Let me throw something here, too. Long before the music industry got so huge and terribly commercialized, most musicians thought that having steady gigs, decent record sales, some royalties, and being able to play every night was the epitome of your success.
Your art. Yeah.
Yeah, that's art. But now it's a matter of let's get in, get the money before everything.
It's all about promotion.
It's promotion. Get in, get big.
The industry,
get the sales, and then get out.
The industry's considerably different than it was
thirty years ago. Yeah.
Because it used to be you would go on tour to promote an album.
Right.
Now it's you release an album to promote your tour.
Well, that's the money is.
The money yeah. now comes from the live performances.
Shows.
It doesn't come from record sales.
This is different from what was 30 years ago, arguably by anything. I mean, that's just the nature of our culture has shifted.
Yeah, but it's different fundamentally in how the business works too.
Well, but David's right though. It is a reflection on the culture though.
Right.
When we can have accessibility like we have now, they're going to have to evolve in order to.
In fact, I'd argue that.
But they also at this time musicians have much more freedom in which way they can run their careers. They can run their whole career themselves, handle the promotion, the production, and everything else. Or they can let somebody else do it. It depends on how big they want to be.
It's actually
how much they want to put themselves into it.
It's actually a cool shift now because you had this decentralized distribution of music, and then we had a very centralized distribution of music, and now with the internet and all of the self-publishing that's going on, you're actually seeing a lot of the indie bands move away from that traditional model mm-hmm. until right. they get signed and then they get offered money.
But a lot of them aren't even. Like Jeff and I are going to go see this band called Band of Heathens, and they completely produce all their own stuff. They run it all through their own website.
Mm-hmm.
They give a crap load out for free even, but they have complete control over their music.
Look at somebody like Jonathan Colton, mm-hmm. which he's big in that geek community, but he started out as a stay-at-home dad who released one song a week on a podcast.
Yep.
And that was his claim to fame. That, and then he did I Like Big Butts as a boy band song. And that kind of took him to another level. But he's done all this just on his own.
Right.
I don't think he's got any kind of record contract. I know for the longest time, you could go to his website and download every song he produced. And it would be kind of great if you gave $10,
yeah.
You know. And people did. I mean, they just, because of their appreciation for what he did, they gave.
You've also seen, in terms of, talk about the culture shift. So 30 years ago, you didn't spend as much discretionary income on entertainment as you do now. So buying a record was a bigger deal mm-hmm. than buying
yeah,
a CD.
Well, yeah, well, mm-hmm. there was also a smaller number of choices, too.
Right. So
you actually had to go to a store, comb through the racks, if you heard on the radio, buy the album.
And realistically, the price of...
An album,
a set of music, a grouping of songs mm-hmm. hasn't really changed in the dollar amount, which if you expand mm-hmm. out for inflation, we used to pay a whole hell of a lot more for this stuff than we do now.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd pay...
Maybe that's why Adam doesn't have an emotional response to music. He doesn't have to pay enough for it.
Yeah. But still, when you bought an album, though...
I'm not very emotionally tied to money.
When you bought an album, though, you got the album, the cover art, you got the liner notes... And whatever posters or anything they stuffed inside them too. I mean,
well, and 20 artwork yeah. alone was something that.
Well, that's what sold a lot of albums, basically on the cover art.
Well, and they kind of play to that a little bit in Velvet Goldmine. The whole mm-hmm. idea of the artwork and and the image and the marketing.
The image is everything.
Yeah.
All right, so Jeff says, Lester uses his over-the-top and exaggerated statements that he clearly does not believe to disguise the kernel of truth buried within
so that he does not have to risk rejection of his true feelings about music. If Lester's opinions are rejected, he can accept the rejection of the persona, but like the Band-Aids, he is a true fan and cannot stand up to the rejection of his true emotional connection to the music. Almost Famous is a movie about when money gets in the way of music, so the fans care more about the music than the artists. And that's the thesis of the end of the movie. They pretty much say that. I mean, when Billy so dresses down Russell
Jeff
for
cheated, which is copied off somebody else.
Yeah, basically, he's cutting and pasting from something, obviously.
Jeff.
No, it's when Billy dresses down Russell at the end. He's like, "Look, you are throwing these people away. Your Band-Aids are not just groupies. They are the people that care about the music."
Well, and Penny
you
Lane's
claim
your number one fan.
Yeah,
and
you claim this
Band-Aid.
Yeah. You claim that this is all about the fans, that you're doing this for the fans. But your biggest fans, you are trading away for a case of beer and $50.
Yep.
And that is an indictment against you and what you have become. You are not who you say you are. You suck.
Yeah, asshole.
And, yeah.
That was pretty much it. That was a great scene.
Smells too much like a John Cusack movie.
It's Cameron Crowe.
I can only tell you what it smells like, Tony. You're drawing your own conclusions.
Well, any other final thoughts on this movie?
Well, all business, Daryl. All right.
I want to see it again. I want to see more. I just don't.
Because you missed the penis.
Because I missed the penis. Yes. Yeah, I need to see that.
He needs to do some manscaping.
I need to pause.
It was the 70s.
That's not an excuse.
No, it's just the
apparently. Apparently, it was. no, I just kind of want to see more. Because there's so much going on. Because it was probably about 45 minutes in that I realized that where I was focusing my attention on the story wasn't the focus of the story. And I kind of want to go back and watch for... I just blanked on his name. Christian Bale's character. I want to watch his story more closely.
I think his name was Bartholomew Gout. Don't quote me on that. Tony, who's this movie for? I always thought this was a silly segment.
People who were alive in the 70s and liked music.
Double burn. Well, now that we've heard from the old gallery.
Who do you think these movies are?
I think we should do the segment at the beginning of the review.
Okay.
First off.
That way,
off,
if it's not for you, you can turn off.
You can just move along?
Yeah.
Hey, this isn't for you.
Yeah.
Piss off.
Yeah. You don't get to watch this. And then they're going to want to.
Maybe.
It's an emotional connection we're creating with our audience.
Jeff asked, what kind of beer? Wasn't it a case of Heineken?
It was Heineken, yeah. Case of Heineken and 50 bucks.
For
Penny Lane.
No, it was all the Band-Aids. It was three of them. It was her, and then, well, God, they had such great names.
Oh, yeah.
Shoot.
Why you looked that up? I think that this movie is for people who appreciate the exploration of complex adult relationships or the
bisexuality?
Or
it was
bisexuality.
More than that, yeah.
Or a coming of age story in a turbulent and gritty manner.
Yes.
That's fair.
Ugly coming of age is a very attractive storyline to me. Like Avatar The Last Airbender. That's a very ugly coming of age story.
Yup.
Because he thinks he has to kill a guy. A long time. Then some weird shit happened.
What were those names? Did we...
Oh, yeah. Palexia Aphrodisia was the Anna Paquin one, and then Sapphire.
Anna Paquin. F her, man. I'm tired of seeing her naked.
She was very young in this one.
You don't hear me say that very often, but I'm tired of seeing her naked.
She was very young.
Daryl, what do you got over there?
Okay, who's this movie for? 70s fans, glam fans.
Gross.
Hey, if you like Bowie and you want to kind of see a kind of a semi-autobiography of him, not a bad choice. As close as you're going to get to an autobiography of him on film, anyway.
I would be curious. I'd be curious to see what somebody who was going through discovering that they were gay at the time, what kind of connection they might have to discovering music like this.
Well, I think anybody who feels alienated, though,
well,
I think,
but that's, I mean, that's
this
what
movie.
This movie was about in a way from Arthur's character.
I'm not saying that wouldn't be an interesting discussion. I'm saying that is a very specific scenario. Like, that is not a very broad range of people.
No, I want to talk to that person. That one person. I want to talk to Arthur.
Well, look at some of the interviews with Todd Haynes. I mean, that's...
Is he gay?
Yeah. And it's a thread in a lot of his movies. Is, you know, that coming to kind of understand who you are. But I think anybody who feels alienated, I mean, I think it's a good movie for...
Okay, I'm going to ask
the uncool people.
I'm going to ask the stupid question now. What other movies has Todd Haynes made?
Far From Heaven.
Okay.
Safe, Poison are the ones I've seen. He did the biopic, which I have not seen yet. I'll Be There. It's on about Bob Dylan, where he has six different people playing
there.
Bob Dylan.
I'm not there. Actually, that was suggested to us
by Deuce
to do during the sequence.
No, we could.
Is Deuce? He IM'd me the other day.
He is busy.
That's cryptic enough.
That sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
the other day
so like, in a couple of months, he might be back.
That sucks. He IM'd me and he's like, what do you know about hacking Android devices? And I'm like, nothing. What does this mean? I have no idea. Talk to Tony. I think he did this exact thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the other one he did.
Okay. I haven't seen that one yet. Yeah. So Jeff says it's for everybody who feels alienated and unable to connect with those around them.
Why does he sound so accusatory?
Lena says, I can see having the connection bisexually or any other way to the musician or the celebrity, but if there's no connection to the people in your own world, it's not the same.
I'm not sure I understand.
I don't know that I do either.
Can you clarify that a little bit?
You're still removed?
Yeah. Well, didn't everybody feel a little sexual tension at, you know, McGregor's penis like I did? Is that just me? Like a bisexual.
It's about the desire to find a connection.
Yeah, to not
and
feel,
I see that. Yeah.
Not to feel like an alien from another planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So having the connection to something public that you can't express.
Which kind of goes to that one scene, the dream sequence, where he's jumping up and down and saying, that's me. He identifies with someone finally.
But can't say it out loud.
Right.
Till he runs away to London.
Yep.
I'm not gonna.
He didn't run away.
He was looking at me all but thrown out.
Yeah. I mean.
Podcast 200.
Yeah. Podcast 200. Surprise. I like man meat. That's why I bring Sam and everything
that,
we do.
That's Two on Food, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar. It's going to be the movie we do on that episode.
Yeah.
Oh. Wait, when's Pax Precious 200? We already passed.
We've already did that. We did that at our archive.
Oh, Jesus. What number are we on in this?
This is like 225, 6, something like that.
I guess we're playing the 200 podcast episode, too.
Yeah, we did 200 at Archon.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And it looks like
I was there.
Yeah, 200... Looks like 250 might happen at the next arc.
Wow.
That's the rate we're going.
That's good timing.
Yeah.
Hey, did you see on... So I've been doing those Feedback Fridays for the podcast.
Yeah.
Did you see the latest one?
No.
The latest one I did was tell me something awesome about the podcast, and somebody wrote in your review and analysis of Lord of the Rings was one of the best things I've ever heard in my life. And I'm like, that wasn't even this show.
That's,
that was filler content.
That's awesome. Because that was Baxi Producers.
That was Baxi Producers.
That's awesome.
That was
it was a great show.
Dude, so we went there. Before All American Regions, we had steak at Porter's.
Yeah.
And so we got there too early, the restaurant wasn't open, so we were kind of walking around, and we passed that bathroom that was the closest to that room where, like, me, Andrew, and Sam had to pee so bad that, like, we couldn't even run. We were, like, gingerly, like, speed walking to get, like, the full lead
drinking back. Drinking and talking for 2 hours, and then everybody had to pee.
Oh, my God, it was so bad. And I walked past that bathroom, I was like, oh, my testicles hurt just looking at it.
Yep.
We've all been there, right? Come on.
Yep.
All right. I got nothing else.
Okay.
Next week, Rockstar.
Yep.
All right. See you.
Thank you for coming.